This week, we begin a series of interviews about the craft of writing. We'll be talking with several winners of the Best Magazine Writing Awards for 2004. Their stories are collected in a new book. We start with Katherine Boo. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner who's covered social policy issues for The Washington Post. She's now a staff writer for The New Yorker and recently won a MacArthur Genius Grant for her work. Boo's award-winning story for The New Yorker appeared in August last year and was called The Marriage Cure. In it, Boo profiles two single women in Oklahoma City who take to heart the Bush administration's message that marriage is a way out of poverty. Kim Henderson is 22. Her friend Corrine Brothers is 49, a divorced single mother of five. Here's an excerpt from The Marriage Cure.
Corrine's husband had remarried 6 months after the divorce. Corrine had had one second date in 12 years. Mornings now, she interrogated the mirror with new ruthlessness, curious about whether Preparation H could, as she'd heard, reduce the puffiness around one's eyes. If five children had altered her face for the worse, they had at least erased the evidence of her malnourished childhood as a Central Florida field hand. "You're 90 pounds with two bricks in your pockets," boys had teased her then. Now she was shaped like a Coke bottle, and Coke-colored, too, red and gold glints in dark brown skin. Her cheekbones were still high, her eyes were alive with humor.
Katherine Boo came into our studios this week to talk about writing. She is a slight, quiet woman with skin almost translucently pale, and she was openly nervous about being on the other end of an interview. Boo says she began her story by signing up for a state-funded class promoting marriage.
I didn't go as a participant, but it was engaging. I mean, it's a bunch of women sitting around talking about relationships. It's pretty hard to be detached from that.
How did you pick the two women that you ended up profiling, Kim Henderson and Corrine Brothers?
I like their honesty. When you write about what we call characters, subjects, one thing that deters me is a person who's really desperate to have their story told. And the people who most interest me are the ones who, when you say, "Can I follow you around?" go, "Well, I don't know." What? Why? Because I often find that their stories are the ones I most want to hear.
So they weren't so keen to have you hanging around for all that time.
It's a real commitment on the part of the people you write about. And one of the things that we always talk about in doing such stories is, you know, you try to say, "This, I'm going to be sitting at your table when you get on the bus to go to work. I'm going to be there too. And are you game?" I would never let anyone do with my life what I do to theirs. I don't think I have that courage, and certainly I don't have that trust. It's weird.
As you go through the story, it's not just about their search for a man, it's their search to themselves figure out how to get out of the deep poverty they're in. And there's a part of the story where Kim, the younger woman, is trying to go get a job in a shopping mall way across town.
Right.
Her phone's been disconnected. She can't follow up on these employers. So she goes to catch the bus, and you're, I presume, with her in the story,
mm-hmm,
getting the
yes.
bus. During the course of this day, bus after bus refuses to stop for her. She's black, and they just whiz right on by, and you get the sense this is how it always is. It's very frustrating to read that, and it's something that, in speaking with colleagues, it stuck out from this story. You're white. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, where were you? Were you hiding? Didn't you feel like, this is ridiculous, and didn't you want to get in the street and flag down the bus?
If I have any gifts at all, one of them is invisibility. And part of reporting stories is the great photographer Walker Evans said, stare, and you find a place in the background, and you listen. And if the bus goes by, you don't flag it down. If somebody's phone is disconnected and they're trying to get a job, you don't pull out your credit card and settle their bill. No, you want to watch what people do do with what they have. It's a morally tricky thing, and you know, all of journalism is morally tricky. But I think that you get a better sense of how people live their lives if you let them live it and stare.
You were so into these people's lives. I mean, in the first paragraph, you describe the younger woman pulling on jeans over a gold lamé thong. How did you know that?
It showed.
But why? What's the importance of the thong up front there? It's to put down a stereotype that you're then going to debunk, or...
Yeah, that's... I'm always stunned in my reporting how spectacularly wrong my first impressions are. I mean, just time and again, I will decide that person's this or that, and I never get any better at getting it right. I'm always wrong. So in a way, when I'm writing, I'm that girl in the low-rider jeans and the gold lame thong was what I saw first, and I had my own assumptions, and I kind of want to take you with me as I figure out that, well, no, there's a lot more going on in this woman's head and heart than I first guessed.
You told these two women you would never let a reporter follow you around.
Yeah.
And you're quite nervous being interviewed.
I think a lot of writers are shy, and they use writing as a way to mediate through the world, and that, you know, the notebook as a protective device. And I think, too, that a lot of us become writers because we're not really good at speaking. So we have to find another way to communicate.
Catherine Booth, thanks for coming to speak with us.
Thank you.
To read The Marriage Cure and other writings by Catherine Booth, go to our website, npr.org.